All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm going to be real fast with the intro today because we got an overflowing barrel of a show here today, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with musician, trombonist, seashellist, okay? He plays seashells. I'm not kidding here. Then it's beautiful. His name is Steve Turay, and we're going to be talking about a piece on his latest album, Spirit Man, and the piece is called Trayvon's Blues, all right, for Trayvon Martin. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about April 14th and what's going on there, the vision and where things are at and what's the importance of it. Before that, we'll be talking with Cephas Johnson, better known to people as Uncle Bobby, the uncle of Oscar Grant, and we're going to be talking with him about the call to shut it down on April 14th. And joining us now at the top end of the show, I'm very pleased to welcome LaTanya Goldsby. And LaTanya is the cousin of Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old young man, boy, child, actually murdered by Cleveland police, November 2014. LaTanya, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you.
Sure. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about Tamir?
Well, Tamir was a 12-year-old child. He was born in June 2002. Very active child, you know, active at school, active in the community, the recreation center where the incident took place. He was very active in the sport leagues and stuff over there. So, you know, the community was, well, you know, knew Tamir and knew, you know, his circumstances and stuff like that. But he's a well-rounded 12-year-old, you know.
Mm-hmm. He's just like any other 12-year-old in the world.
Yes. Just, you know, a 12-year-old little boy.
That's right. And now, Tamir was in the park that day, and he was playing with a toy gun. And then he was murdered. How did the murder happen?
Well, from what, you know, has been placed in the media and, you know, what we've been told is that, you know, there were 3 911 calls that came in about a young man in the park with a toy gun or what was assumed to be a gun. And from what I saw of the video, you know, the police just rolled up on the scene and shot him dead. You know, there was no, you know, there's obviously no audio on the video, but, you know, from what we could see, there was no time for him to respond or give a reaction to anything. You know, at 12 years old, how can you comprehend something so spontaneously? You know, just, I mean, it just happened so quickly for him. There was no way that he would have even known what was going on.
Within 2 seconds, the cop had shot him.
Well, we've learned that it was less than 1 second. To
wow.
be exact, there was 0.792 seconds.
Amazing. Just so thoroughly.
Yeah. And, you know, our thing is that how can you assess a situation in that amount of time?
You know, and you think about a young child sitting there and playing with, I mean, I remember my son, you know, he'd be playing, doing what? Playing whatever with little toy guns or whatever outside, you know, and
yeah.
you don't think about anybody's going to think it's real. You don't think about, you know, you're going to suddenly look up and be confronted by the savage monster that's in less than a second
yeah.
is going to kill you, you know. And imagine just the terror that one child must have faced, you know. And
yeah.
I wanted to say this. One of the things I read and something that you brought out was that not only did they slaughter him, but they actually left him laying there on the ground for quite some time without giving him any medical assistance at all.
Mm-hmm. 4 minutes to be exact. there was an FBI agent that was in the area responding to a different call when this call for Tamir Rice came across the radio. And it wasn't until that FBI officer got into the scene where Tamir was that first aid was actually administered.
You know,
tragic.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. It's tragic.
We
and
believe
in...
that it's very tragic. You know, we believe that officers put in that position, there needs to be some type of accountability for that. You know, we look for these people to protect us, to mm-hmm. not administer first aid to a child. I mean, how horrible is that?
Well, and it gets worse as it goes along. I mean, you can think about that. That yes, that's extremely horrible, and it gets worse as it goes along. Because when I read the things that you have said and other things about the case, it was just astounding. I mean, I'm thinking about this. Look, Tamir is laying on the ground dying, and then his sister, who's only 2 years older than him, sees this. And why don't you tell people what happened to her? Because that was one of the, again, a very brutal thing.
Yes, it was. You know, Tajay and Tamir, very close. You know, they share the same mother and father, so their connection is like no other brother and sister. You know, there's that bond. Mm-hmm. So when she was actually, when she actually found out that that was her brother, you know, she took off out of the building to go to his side. You know, and when she got to the scene where the police officers were, she was tackled, thrown to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in the back of the police car to watch her dying brother on the ground. Mm. For 30 minutes, she was held in that police car.
It's so heavy. You think about this, the whole idea, and even, I don't know, it's just, it's astounding. It's astounding what goes on here. And you think about the city has actually, the city and the police have consistently attempted to lie their way out of this. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about the lies they told and what they did to really try to turn the blame on everyone from Tamir himself to his family.
Yes. You know, when this first came out, you know, there was supposed to have been a group of kids sitting under the gazebo with Tamir. And, you know, he was sitting at the table with a group of children. And the officer saw Tamir pick up the gun and put it in his waistband. Well, all those things seemed to contradict what the video showed. There was no children around. If you look at the video, you can actually see the 1911 caller sitting up under the gazebo. Then he disappears and Tamir sit down. There were no children out there. That's one of the lies that was stated. The fact that they said he reached for the gun, I've never seen watching that video where his hands came out of his pocket. You know, that officer shot, I don't know if he shot through the door, through the window, but he shot Tamir so fast that, I mean, you couldn't even tell what took place.
Yeah, you know, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with LaTanya Goldsby, the cousin of Tamir Rice, and we're talking about the savage murder by police of her cousin Tamir Rice back in November of 2014. Now, LaTanya, one of the things that actually, you know, when we talk about the city actually lying, one of the things that really enraged me when I found out about it is that the city actually initially, their report on it, blamed Tamir for his own death. Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, how can you blame a 12-year-old for his own death? Mm-hmm. That makes no sense to me. I mean, given the fact that he's a child and the adults that were responding to the situation should have used sound judgment. Sound judgment, you know, that would have played a key role in the situation with Tamir, and I believe he would still be here with us today if they had to assess the situation properly. Mm-hmm. You know, they are at fault for not assessing that situation.
Right. And actually what the city did say in their first report that they issued, and then they got embarrassed, supposedly, but they said that the youth was responsible for not taking moves that would prevent his own injury. You know, and you're thinking, what?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what other moves you could make that would prevent a gung-ho police officer from shooting you. I mean, what? Even if he had to put his hands up in the air, that sudden movement, you would have shot him still.
Right.
I mean, what else would have been the outcome?
Right. And when you look at it, too, this is not to say that Tamir had actually made any move for his gun, but even in Ohio, you know, because we had to think about this with the killing of John Crawford. In Ohio, it's an open carry state. It's actually legal to carry guns. But these cops came up and on a child just opened fire, like you said, in less than a second. And even when you listen to the report to the police and the person is saying, well, you know, it's probably a fake. You know, it looks like it's a fake. He's a juvenile, you know, and they come up and the cops come up and they have done everything. They've tried to, you know, claim that he looked like he was in his late teens or something. And then they bring out whatever dirt they could find on the family and make up dirt or whatever, whether it was real or not. And they tried to smear the family in the newspaper, everything to cover up the fact that what they did is part of an overall genocidal assault on black and brown people in this country.
Yes, it is. And, you know, it's an epidemic that's plaguing this country worldwide. You know, the Tamir Rice situation has now gone national. You know, but he's not the only family that's affected by situations like this. There are millions of people that are going through the same issue with us. And it's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. You know, Cleveland has not one, but several incidents of use of deadly force. And it's just horrible. Mm-hmm. Considering with the recent DOJ report that just came out, I don't understand how these situations just continue to keep happening.
Mm-hmm. And they will continue until people stand up and do something about it. We're going to have to move on, but I do want you to, in less than 1 minute, if you could just tell us where things stand now.
Well, right now, the family has a petition online at change.org. This petition is going down to the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office to demand that charges are filed against these officers involved in the Tamir Rice shooting. There's also a GoFundMe memorial set up for in honor of Tamir. You know, we're just asking the community to help us out. You know, there's a lot of expenses that are going on that we're trying to get the word out about Tamir. We're going to be taking out an ad to promote this petition, so that's where some of the funding will be going.
All right, LaTanya, thank you very much for joining us today, and keep us posted on as things develop, okay?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with LaTanya Goldsby, cousin of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old child that was murdered by the Cleveland police in November of 2014. And I'll tell you something, folks, this show is going to be talking about police murder and the savage attacks on the people by the police on black and brown people. And a recent government report on police killings in the U.S. revealed that the FBI statistics on deaths ignored more than half of those actually killed. The new report states that for the last 8 years, at least an average of 928 people have been killed year after year by the cops in the U.S. And researchers who specialize in estimating unreported violent deaths argue that the true number of killings is probably higher. And we're also going to be talking about how to stop it. We're going to be talking about April 14th and the battle to stop police terror and murder. We're going to be talking about April 14th and all across the country, people stepping out to say, shut it down. Shut down business as usual. This is where we stop police murder of black and brown people. And right now we are going in and we're going to be listening to a piece from Juanita Young talking about A14.
Of Malcolm Ferguson. My son was murdered March 1st of 2000. Since the murder of my son, I've been out here in support of other families who have had their loved ones murdered by this NYPD. It is so important that people come out and stand with these families so that the police know that the community is not taking the police murder that is being done out here on a regular basis. Since the murder of my son, I've been out here 15 years, and it has gotten worse, not better. All they do is attack the families and justify the killing by coming up with these crazy stories. The problem is, the people believe it. Instead of hearing both sides, you get the media version coming from the police. That's why the wife had to stand here and defend John, because the media didn't defend him. They destroyed him, like they did. They do all the families when they murder a loved one in their family. We feel the only way that we stop this police murder, they want to come after us, we coming back after them double time. Because if you feel you can murder our innocent child, I'm not going to tell you what I feel. I'm going to tell you what I want. Let's bring them down, too. And no matter whatever means necessary, we got to stop police murder and police brutality. On April 14th, we need to hurt New York really bad. We need to stop people from going to the store. We need to stop the buses from running. We need to stop these teachers from getting paid. Whatever it takes, block the streets. No, you can't go on that bridge. No, we don't want you to make no money today. Whatever way you feel you could be of any value, come out on April 14th, stand with the victims and the stolen lives and saying, we tired of police brutality. We tired of mass incarceration, all these people in jail for what? From the DA, the police department, to the judges. They all sleep in the same bed. So what do? When you all want to sleep in the same bed, burn that bed down. Thank you.
That was Juanita Young, and Juanita Young is the mother of Malcolm Ferguson, murdered by the New York Police Department in March 2000. Since that time, she has been a tireless member of the October 22nd Coalition, the Stolen Lives Project, and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. All right, and I'll tell you what we're going to do now. We're going to have to shift the schedule around a little bit. I was initially going to have Uncle Bobby Cephas Johnson, or as he's known to people all over the world, Uncle Bobby, the uncle of Oscar Grant, the young man who was killed by the BART Transit Police up in Oakland, California on New Year's Eve 2009. We're going to keep trying to reach Uncle Bobby, but while we're doing that, I thought I'd shift it over and give you a chance to hear from Carl Dix. I had the opportunity to talk with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network just before the show. So we'll just move right into that interview, and hopefully we'll be talking with Uncle Bobby as our next segment. This is Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network talking about April 14th, the vision and where it's at and what we need to do. So check this out. And joining us now to talk about A14 is a regular guest on the show and someone that we don't ever hear too much from. We need to hear a lot more from him. It's Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, Carl, we're going to jump right into this. April 14th, what's it about and why is it so damn important?
What April 14th is about is retaking the initiative in the movement to stop this society from giving a green light to police to brutalize and even murder people. Because this is a horror that has been going on for decades. It is intensifying, and it is right out in the face of society. It's right out in the face of society because of the protest movement of last year following the exoneration of the cops who murdered Michael Brown and Eric Garner. People poured into the streets. That was beautiful. That was powerful. And it put this issue on the front burner. It challenged others to stand up. It opened the eyes of many people. The authorities came back hard with mass arrests, threats, and false promises attempting to suppress this movement, and frankly have had some impact. They've worked to change the story from police brutalizing and murdering people and being exonerated by the legal system to police having a tough job that they're doing heroically. April 14th has got to be bringing the narrative back to what it really is, and that is that police have a green light to murder people, especially Black and Latino people. The whole court system, the media, the politicians act to exonerate them when it happens. It is illegitimate and unacceptable, and we must act to stop it. And April 14th is the day. All across the country, cities, campuses, no work, no school, people have to take to the streets and disrupt business as usual in America, because America's business as usual includes police murdering Black and Latino people and the whole system going into motion to exonerate them when they do it.
Now, this April 14th is something that you and Cornel West actually have been in the forefront of. Actually, I don't know whether you extended that first announcement of it, the call for April 14th, but the two of you have been in the forefront of this. Let's give people a real sense of the vision of this, and then where are we at in it now? We have 1 week really left open before the event, and that's a lot of time on one level. On the other, another level, it's not that much time. So let's talk about, you know, a little bit more concrete, the vision, and then where are we at?
Yeah, I mean, concretely, people have to pour into the streets, major thoroughfares, streets, highways, bridges. Business as usual and all of that has got to be halted. It's got to be ground to a halt. State capitals need to be taken over. Campuses, what's got to happen on campuses all across the country? Thousands of students have to be involved in saying what's happening on this campus today is that we are acting to stop wanton police murder of Black and Latino people and the system giving that a green light. That's what April 14th has got to be about. And we are not where we need to be. We got to really push this out. Many more people need to know about this. It's got to be spread through social media. Students have to get the stickers, the posters that have pictures of the lives that have been stolen, you know, at the hands of the cops, spreading that on their campuses. This has got to be spread in the communities where people have to live this day to day. It has to be taken into the religious institutions. It's got to be taken everywhere, and people got to be called on to take a stand, because this is like a slow genocide that's going down, and we cannot act as if it's not happening. We cannot stand aside from it. This is everybody's problem. It's not just a Black or Latino problem. And what we need to do is to really push this out and to give every advance that we make a multiplier effect.
Now, Carl, I heard you speak just the other night, and one of the things that was very moving to me, at any rate, and I think to everybody that was in the audience, is you talked about the moral imperative involved in all this. And I think it's something that people really need to, one, can't be reminded of too much, but really need to grasp pretty deeply. You talked about historical parallels, and you talked about the real existent moral imperative today. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, because, see, a lot of times people will say to us, you're being harsh, Carl. Don't say it's murder. Say it's maybe police misconduct. And other people will say, and sometimes the same people will say, well, you're going about it wrong. You know, you shouldn't be fighting this. You should be sitting down with the powers that be and discussing new policies and changes that will deal with this problem. And I have to say to them, should the enslaved Africans on the plantations have gone to the slave masters and asked them to appoint officials to oversee and smooth out the process of slavery? Or should they have risen up against slavery, ran away from slavery, and when they got the chance, participated in the Civil War to end it? Should Jewish people have petitioned the Nazis to work out the kinks in the Holocaust? Or did people, Jewish and non-Jewish, need to stand up before people got to the death camps and say, this needs to stop? That's the parallel that we're dealing with. And see, people's lives are at issue here because police, like just this year alone, in the first 85 days, police have killed 78 unarmed people. That doesn't count all of the people that they say were armed, including people that had screwdrivers or rocks, because they consider those deadly weapons and a license to kill people. That's what's going on. And if we stand aside and don't act to stop this, not only will more lives be lost, but our humanity will be lost, because humanity demands that when we see horrors like this going down, we don't stand aside, we don't turn our eyes and act like they're not happening, that we stand up and say, we will not allow this to go down. And that's what people have to do on April 14th. They have to meet the challenge of saying, this is a horror, people are being killed, it concentrates a slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people, and I will not be a good German. I will not turn my eyes away the way far too many people did in the face of Jewish people being dragged off to the death camps in Nazi Germany.
You know, Carl, you said something the other night that I'm just going to repeat because it was extremely moving. You said, you know, you could be like many Germans who did when the Jewish people were being dragged off. You could be somebody who stood there and just started to spray, you know, air freshener all around their head and just to get the sweet smell of all this and to block out the smell, the stench of death. And you made the point that even if you spray that air spray, that fresh air spray there, that may stop the stench from reaching your nose, but it's not going to stop the reality of the genocidal death that's going on, the genocidal murder that's going on. And I think that's really important for people to sort of wrestle with as they're thinking about all this.
Yeah, I think that's right on target. Our humanity is demanding that we act, and April 14th is the day to do it. Spread the hashtag, shut down A14, get the stickers, go to the website, stopmassincarceration.net. You can find all kinds of material there. Also, go to the website, revcom.us. There's material, there's coverage, there's videos of students who are going to act on April 14th from campuses around the country. People can add their own videos and their plans to act by going to that website. This must stop, and it's up to us to stop it. Shut down A14.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right. Once again, that was Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Take off your shackles. Cast off your trammels. Be not restrained, be never tamed. cast off your manacles. Untie your bridle, push off your boulders. Unwrap your chains, they can't contain. Unclasp your manacles.
All right, welcome back. That was Silver Chains by The Men They Couldn't Hang. I read some statistics earlier, and I just want to add a new one in here because the horrendous rate of police killing may actually be going up. KilledByPolice.net, a website that uses corporate news reports on people killed by law enforcement, counted 115 people killed just last month. That's right, March of 2015. Now, I want you to listen to a trailer that was made advertising April 14th, Shut It Down. And then we'll be right back with Uncle Bobby.
After all the demonstrations last summer and fall, after all the promises and all the investigations that went nowhere, after the hundreds and hundreds of arrests, the police are still brutalizing and murdering Black and Latino people. Hundreds a year and getting away with it in every city and town of America.
Now, whenever you don't say anything, whenever you allow them to get away with it, what you're essentially saying is that person that died did not matter.
April 14th, a good impact is that we can't continue to sit here and be silent anymore.
So we gotta do April 14th. And April 14th has got to be a day when thousands and thousands of young people, students at colleges, high schools, young people who are out of school, young people who dropped out of school, young people who got pushed out of school, know that that's the day to act, because we have to stop this.
Thus died Eric Garner in Staten Island, savagely murdered by the New York City Police Department. And what happens? The cops let off again. You know, I don't see how anybody could listen to that and not think that this is completely unacceptable. Completely unacceptable. Joining us now to talk about April 14th, what brought him to involvement in it, and the rest of it, is Oscar Grant's uncle. His name is Cephas Johnson. He's better known to everybody as Uncle Bobby. And Oscar Grant was a 22-year-old Black man who was killed by the transit police in Oakland, California on January 1st, 2009. He was handcuffed and face down when the pig shot him in the back in cold blood. Uncle Bobby, welcome to the show.
Again, thank you for having me. I'm online.
You recently said that the situation today is a state of emergency. Explain that.
Well, you know, I've been saying for a long time that the number that we see that's been reported is not really the number of how many young Black and brown men that's being killed across the country. We have always seen the low figure, but it came to my knowledge some years ago that most of the police agencies does not report the actual so-called shootings when it leads to death to a national database, with, say, with the Department of Justice. And coming to that knowledge, I knew that the number had to be much more higher, and how to actually galvanize and get that number became a task and a work on my part. So just referring to a lot of different entities that has actually done research we've come to find out now, even more recently, that on an average, 900 to 1,000 is killed per year. And with that being said, you know, this is a genocidal state of young men being killed all across this country by law enforcement officers that are sponsored by the state. You know, the same state that creates the homelessness, you know, the unemployment, those that don't have health insurance and what have you. So with that being all said, it is a state of emergency. War has been launched against the black and brown men across this country with the state-sponsored police and killing us. And every single one of these killings, at least 99% of them are considered justifiable homicide, and officers never held accountable. Mm-hmm. You know, and with Oscar's case being the first officer in California state history for an on-duty shooting of a black and brown man to actually be convicted, even though it was a slap in the face, but he just did 11 months for involuntary manslaughter, it was historical. You know, and it hasn't happened before Oscar, and it hasn't happened after Oscar. So every single one of these shootings that we see here in the state of California, no officers held accountable. But not only that, all across this nation, it is a rare incident where maybe an officer is held accountable. But those we don't even know about, you know. And so I'm just saying that knowing this, that so many young men are dying at the hands of police officers, not every 28 hours, but at least every 8 hours, if not every 8 hours, even every 4 hours when we really get the number, that to me is a state of emergency. And we have to address this police killing that is happening all across this country. That's why April 14th also is critical in the date that we all need to come out and recapture the momentum that we had with the Ferguson shooting of Michael Brown, to let those that are trying to put this movement to sleep know that people are not going to sleep. This type of killing has to stop. You know, war has been launched against us, and we have to face it, we have to deal with it, and we have to stop it.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Uncle Bobby, Oscar Grant's uncle, and we're talking about April 14th and the police genocidal assault in this country on black and brown people. Now, Uncle Bobby, one of the things that you said when you talked about this, and you began to hit at this, that Black Lives Matter, you've really been grabbed onto that, and you said that, but for that to be more than just words, for those lives to actually matter, you have to be outraged. Let's talk about that.
Right. You know, many of us love Martin Luther King, but he also stated, too, there comes a time when silence is betrayal. So we say to all those that know this is going on, or even have a question in their mind that, you know, something is happening here and they quite can't figure it out, you have a responsibility to become involved to change the genocidal assault that's happening with black and brown men across this country. And your failure to become involved means you're accepting the system as is, which means you are really just as culpable for allowing a system to continue to perpetrate this type of crime on people, innocent people at that. You know, they allow the system to continue to get away with murder. So it's important that we all rise up and speak to this. Michelle Alexander said it best in her book, Mass Incarceration in the Time of Color Blindness, The New Jim Crow. It's going to take a mass movement to change what we see happening today. And so we call on everyone to be a part of this movement. We call on everyone to come out on April 14th to show their outrage, to speak to this heinous act that we see consistently happening every day across this country. And if you are appalled at what you see, or if you even question whether the system is actually committing the genocidal assault that it's committing, you need to be involved, because this is not something that is supposed to happen. This is one of these countries that has the highest killing rate of all countries in the world when it comes to young black and brown men across this country.
Mm-hmm. You know, you cited the thing about Martin Luther King, and I thought that was really important, the idea that silence in a time like this is betrayal. And I wanted to talk about this again because, the murders show that time and again, you've made this statement as well, the murders show that time and again that black people have absolutely no rights that this system is bound to respect. You know, it brings you back to the Dred Scott decision. And then you couple that with King's statement about silence is betrayal. That's a pretty heavy stand to be taking to people.
Yes. I mean, it's just a fact that, you know, people say, well, racism is gone. You know, the form of racism that we knew in the time of slavery is gone. Well, you know, today the system is set up on institutionalized racism and structural racism. And we're all clear. Everyone in this society, I would hope, is clear that there are some disparities in how the criminal justice system laws are applied to people of color versus people of white. And if we're clear in understanding that there is some form of discrepancy, that then that discrepancy has to be dealt with. You know, and what we're seeing is institutionalized racism being implemented on a people of color at an unprecedented rate than it ever has been. You know, we have more men, as you know, in this country locked up than those around this world. More specifically, more black men in this country is locked up than any other black man around this world. You know, and so, and not every, and we're seeing almost every month, and if not every month, every 2 weeks now, another young man being released for being falsely incarcerated, you know, done dead 20, 30 years. You know, and we see this happening on a regular, consistent basis now. You know, and so this is just telling us that this criminal justice system is a racist criminal justice system. Laws has been passed that has totally taken away our rights to what we thought in this country would be real freedom, justice, and equality, which in essence is not the truth, because so many of us today is not only being killed, but even incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. All right, Uncle Bobby, one more question for you. Where are you going to be on April 14th, and what's in your head, what's it got to look like?
Well, myself personally, I will be at the Oscar Grant Plaza, which is downtown Oakland, with the people there. And what it has to look like that business as usual must stop. That means people, that means students must walk out of school. Or that means students, white students that are in well-to-do neighborhoods must pick up signs that says Black Lives Matter and actually go out into the street and speak to this very issue. It means that people from all over this country must be aware that everyone is stepping out and speaking to this issue, and that the movement is not going away. You know, this system, from its very foundation, has been built off of racism, and it has to be addressed. And the only way to address and unravel and break up this sick system is for people to come out and get involved, to change the whole paradigm of what we see when it comes to young black and brown and poor whites being killed all across this country.
All right, Uncle Bobby, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, well, thank you again for having me.
Sure. Talk to you again soon, man. Keep us posted, all right?
I sure will.
All right, take care now. All right, we're going to listen to something right now, and I want you to just sit back and check this, all right? And then we'll come in and we'll talk to you about who it is. So check this out now. Thank you. All right, all right. I can't. It takes the life out of me to bring that down, but I really, because we're pressed for time, I really want to get into who this is, all right? And this is an incredible piece. If you've been listening to this, you know that this is just an amazing, amazing piece. And what we're doing with this, what's being done with this, is just conjuring up so much in my own mind and my own heart. And it's from Steve Turay's new album, which is called Spirit Man, and the piece is called Trayvon's Blues. See, I lost my breath right there because I'm just very moved by all that's going on. And Trayvon's Blues, it's an amazing piece. And joining us to talk about this is Steve Turay. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sure, man. I got to say, I'm gonna, you know, we'll talk for a minute or so, and then I want to get back up so people can hear the end of the song, because I just think this is an incredible piece. You know what? Maybe we'll just, like, bring it up now and play the rest of it, just as long as I want people to know that you're sitting here, and we'll play the rest of it, and we'll be right back with you, all right?
All right.
All right. Steve Turay, just such a beautiful piece, man. Just an incredibly powerful piece. Steve,
yes.
What moved you to create that?
Well, actually, I usually write at my piano, and I was sitting at the piano, and that vamp came out, which is at the beginning and at the end there. Be-dong, dee-dee-dong, ah, dee-dong, ah, dee-dee-dong, ah. That came out, and I proceeded to develop the song off of that, and I just started, and when I had composed it, the whole Trayvon Martin Zimmerman thing was fresh on the news, and that could have been my son. You know, any kid of color can get that happen to them in this country especially. So I named it Trayvon's Blues because I felt it was very pertinent, and then as I played it, it developed more, and I developed the dynamics and started to see the story in it. It kind of evolved. I performed it for about 6 or 8 months at various gigs before I recorded it. And I'm glad I did because it gave it a chance to develop. And like the first part is soft, and that's when he's just going to the store to get his Skittles and iced tea. But at the bridge, when it changes to the dominant from the minor, when we play it live, we hit it even harder than that. And that's the fight, you know. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, when I'm playing the shells, that at the end is not trombone, that's conch shells. And at the beginning of that, I'm calling for help. He said, help me, you know, that's what that was. And it kind of evolved into a story, and I was able to put it together through performing it, you know.
That's heavy. I was going to ask you that because I read something where you said it evolved that way. And it's really, you know, I was going to ask you about the structure of the song too, because it really does take you on a journey, you know. And by the time you get to the conch shells playing, man, I'm telling you, I mean, I fell in love with your music years ago when I stumbled onto a, you know, something, and there was the song, and I kept saying, what is he playing? And then I found out what it was, and I was like, whoa. And when I listened to this, and just the way you put the conch shells at the end, and the part that you're saying is like, help me, help me. You know, it's helped me, Trayvon saying help me, it's helped me in terms of also, how do you stand up against this? And when you're playing those, you're playing that those conch shells, and it has a way of just invading your heart and taking it over. You know, it's just a totally different sound, man.
Well, yeah, it's more vocal in a certain sense, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a deep thing and an ongoing thing. It's by no means solved the problem. And, you know, to me, stand your ground. Come on, it was murder. And the thing is, the cops told Zimmerman not to mess with Trayvon, that they were on their way. And he did it anyway. Now, so he attacked Trayvon. If Trayvon had killed him and called it stand your ground, do you think he'd still, you know, he'd be under the jail?
Mm-hmm.
Come on, let's be real. If Zimmerman's dad was a judge too? Come on, man.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
This America, man, you know, all things are not equal.
yeah, definitely, man. We're talking with trombonist, conch shell playing man, Steve Touré, and we're talking about his song Trayvon's Blues, which is taken from his new album, Spirit Man. You know, you said that when you play this, it takes a lot out of you.
Physically especially, you know, because the shells, they take more physical energy to play than the trombone. The trombone takes more accuracy and focus and articulation, like it's because you got to articulate every note and match it with the slide, or else it just sounds like glissandos. But with the shell, you got to move a lot of air to get them to speak. And you know, it takes more physical work, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that you were saying when you were talking about what made you feel compelled to write this, I was thinking about this, that how little that is expressed in the world today. You know, and in this country in particular, where you have, you know, we've just had people on here, Tamir Rice's cousin, who, you know, 12-year-old child that was killed by the Cleveland police, and they tried to blame him for his own death, you know, and then we had...
When he had the toy gun?
Yeah.
That was kind of wrong. I mean, listen, I've had the New York City police throw me on the ground and put a gun to my temple, pressing my face into the pavement with the gun barrel, because I was carrying a trombone and they thought I had stolen it.
Uh-huh.
And then I had to show them my union card and some music I had written with my name on it that just happened to be in my trombone case, so they let me go.
Yeah, we can laugh, but on the other hand, it's a disgusting portrayal of what this country is about, man.
And boy. You know, the thing is, it was during a blackout, and people were looting. But I heard a voice out of the darkness say, stop. Now, I don't know who this is. It's dark. They didn't say police. They weren't in uniform. Then I heard another voice say, hey, you, stop. And I started walking faster because I don't know who it is. It's crazy out there on the street. You know, there's no lights. It's dark. And then I hear freeze. Well, I know that means somebody got a gun. So I stopped, and they threw me on the ground. They did all that stuff. And then they let me go. So, oh, you can go now. So I was kind of upset, you know. I said, oh, I can go now. I said, listen, why don't you didn't identify yourself as police. Why don't you go down the street three blocks right there, looting right now? Go down there and do your job instead of messing with people out here trying to go home. And the cop told me, shut up or I'll shoot you now and nobody will ever know anything.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was in early 80s when the big blackout hit the East Coast and the whole East Coast went down.
Mm-hmm.
So things are still going on. You know, it ain't changed, man.
What is it? Have you gotten a response from other musicians and other people?
Man, I get a response everywhere from that tune, everywhere. In fact, I even played in St. Thomas and in Martinique in the Caribbean, and the people there had heard about it and understood, and they loved it, and they had got the message.
Well, we certainly need a hell of a lot more of that, man, a hell of a lot more of that. What do you plan on taking this out? Are you going to be on tour?
Well, yeah, and as much as possible, you know. I know I'll be in San Jose, I think the first week or around that time of August, doing a tribute to Rahsaan, Roland Kirk, and we will play that tune. Even the rest of the music will be Rahsaan's music, but that tune I'm going to put in there, and it fits Rahsaan's spirit.
Absolutely.
He was all about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say that's a perfect match, a perfect match.
And I play it on all my gigs here in the East Coast and at the Detroit Jazz Festival. I'm booked for that. And I'm going to be at Dizzy's in New York. And I'll play it there.
So do other musicians come up and say, yo, man, I think I got to do the same thing? Because it seems to me we have a real lack of people stepping up and stepping out to making this kind of statement.
It's a personal thing. You know, the climate in this country now, it's not about music for the spirit or music for the truth. It's about music for the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And, people want to be, they don't want to take a stand on anything because they don't want to offend anybody anywhere about anything because they just want to make money. It has nothing to do with right or wrong or even how they feel personally. It's another way of looking at things, you know. And I'm not, I don't really try to make a political statement with my music. As far as I'm concerned, I play for just about anybody. I mean, I play for the Tea Party, and hopefully a few of them might feel something and change a little bit. Although I did refuse to go to South Africa years ago because of apartheid. And I wouldn't go there because of that situation. Mm-hmm. But last year, I finally got invited. I went to the Cape Town Jazz Festival, and it was great. But, music, some people, their music is just about political thing, and I think they're using that as a foundation to get attention or something. Not always, but sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to play music for everybody because music has the ability to change people, and you never know. But I still speak the truth. I tell us when I play the song, I tell the people what it's about and explain it before we play it.
And that's what we need a lot more of, Steve. That's the point I was trying to get at. We need a lot more.
And the reason it came out is because I have a son. I have a daughter. Mm-hmm. It could have been them.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, Steve Turre, we've got to wrap this up, but it was great talking with you, and we'll have to have you back, man. And if you come out here, you need to come in live, all right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I hope to be out there soon.
All right, that'll be good, man. That'll be good. Let me know, all right?
Yes, sir.
All right, Steve Turre, thank you very much.
Right.
Talk to you again. Bye now. And once again, we've been talking with musician Steve Turre about his new album, Spirit Man, and in particular, about the cut Trayvon's Blues. Now, I'm going to do something that I don't normally do. I'm going to read a challenge to all the people out there, all the musicians, all the other progressive and prominent people who have the ability to use their platform to influence society, to stand up and say some things that need to be said. And it's to all those with a platform. The police are still killing unarmed people, and this must stop. Call on people throughout society to take part in #ShutDownA14, a day where we come together to say no more to police murder and brutality. The fact that the police are continuing to kill unarmed people, primarily Black and Latino people, is truly intolerable. But it is a painful truth of our time that there would be more outrage and outcry if they did to a dog what they do regularly to Black and brown youth. If you don't speak out and act, and if you don't get others to speak out and act, you are saying it's okay to live in a society that demonizes, casts off, brutalizes, and murders our youth. And it is not okay. Through their silence and inaction, far too many prominent voices in our society, people that are looked to as voices of conscience, are saying it's okay to stand by while this continues. This is the reality. Very few people with disproportionate influence have spoken out against police brutality and murder, and even more stark, almost no well-known white people have taken vocal public stands against this. This is unacceptable, and anyone and everyone with a desire for a society where our youth are not treated to systematic degradation, criminalization, brutality, and murder needs to speak out now. If people are giving you counsel to stay silent, to not act and speak out, then please explain why that's right. Are you so afraid of controversy, of protecting yourself, and the little space you've carved out that you think it's okay for Black and brown people to be killed without speaking up? If so, that's nothing but moral bankruptcy, putting yourself and your position over the lives of millions. Recently, John Legend quoted Nina Simone, "It's an artist's duty to reflect the times in which we live." Her words were a challenge then, a challenge which many of her peers answered, and they stand as a challenge to all of you today. You have an obligation to speak. If you maintain your silence, you are objectively giving approval. Stand up and speak out. Stand with those who suffer from this criminalization and police brutality. Let them know that they're not alone. And even more, let's stand up together to make known to all throughout society that this must stop, and we will not be calm and quiet until this does truly stop. The problem is real. The challenge is real. The role you choose to play in the face of this will also be real. All right, real quick, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board offer today, Federico Garcia. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Steve Turay's Trayvon's Blues. Thank you.